Let me put it this way. I'd like to think that God is real.
I don't believe in God because the idea that an omniscient, loving being would judge me, who is mortal and ignorant based on a few years' experience, I find to be rather a cruel thought.
All the power that God has, he, she, it has given to me. So we're definitely one.
I hope there's something else out there. It'd be fun to experience either that or we're all just evolved apes.
I was raised atheist. I don't believe in a higher power, but I also don't claim to know everything about the world. I don't know. I don't know if there is one. I just pretend, I guess, and hope that there's something else out there.
If you found us online, we are so glad to welcome you in here. I'm Pastor Tim, and we've been in this series now, the second week, as we are exploring God with 1,000-plus other churches all around Chicagoland. And last week, we talked about purpose. You can go online, stmarkslife.org, check out that message. But today, we are going to focus in on this next question. Is there a God? All right? Is there a God? It might be seemingly a very easy, simple answer, and yet there's something beautiful in the complexity within those words. And so what we said last week is you cannot know God apart from the relationships around you. It's not like you can go into a vacuum or somehow experience or know God in and of yourself, all right? And it's true, we need community, we need people around us to explore God together. So find some folks around you. We did this last week. Find some folks around you and do this. Share your name and your favorite cold weather activity. All right? Share your name and your favorite cold weather activity. Don't look at me. My favorite cold weather activity is praying for summer. It's true. Here's the question we want to really dive into today. In your groups, kind of turn back in there and respond to this question. Is there a God? There's really only three answers, yes, no, and I'm not sure. All right, is there a God? And if so, how do you know? Maybe you're like me, and you don't really think about this question a whole lot. It's sort of an assumed yes, but then when you ask that second question, well, if there is a God, which we would believe here at St. Mark's, there is, in fact, a God. If so, then how do I know? I don't really think about that question very often, unless there's something going on in life that really leads me to question that first question once again. Is there a God? It might be a tragedy, it might be a loss of a loved one, and it might be just a really tough season in life where we wonder, God, are you there? And sometimes it's best if we take our cues from our young people. Young people like Allison here, she's 7 years old, she writes this letter, "Dear God, I read the Bible. What does begat mean? Because nobody will tell me." Or Frank, he writes, "God, I bet it's really hard for you to love everybody in the entire world. There are only 4 people in our family. I can never do it." Or Darla, "Did you really mean do unto others as they do unto you? Because if you did, I'm going to go fix my brother." Seymour, he asks, "Dear God, how come you did all those miracles in the days of old, but I don't see any now?" Or Timmy, who writes, "Dear God, I wish there was no such thing as sin. I also don't wish that there was such a thing as war." Or Larry, "Dear God, maybe Cain and Abel would not have killed each other so much if they would have had their own rooms. It works really well with my brother." I think sometimes it's hard to respond to the question, is there a God? And if so, how do you know? Because we can ask God questions like that, like a child. And somewhere deep down, we just wish that there was the neon sign or the voice from the sky that would respond to our questions. And if that would happen, then we would know without a doubt that, in fact, there is a God. I just kind of want to step out of that conversation just for a moment because this is something I'm realizing more and more. I believe we've gone an entire generation, maybe a generation and a half, where in churches we were not really comfortable even asking this question. As I talk to my peers, millennials, if you will, I just learned I'm like a Gen Xer, which I'm kind of having an identity crisis with that one. But 30 and 40-year-olds, 20-year-olds, I mean, this is a question that might be discussed in their peer groups and their friend groups, but never in churches, because it would be assumed, is there a God? The answer is
yes.
Yes. End of story, end of discussion. I've heard stories from students who've gone through our confirmation processes, and when they asked, how do you know there is a God, it was met with silence and with the answer, just believe it, because that's what we believe. No. This question is 100% valid. It's 100% necessary, and it is core to who we are as Christians. And let me just put this out here before I move on. No one in the Bible, are we told, is condemned or is sent to hell because they doubted the existence of a God. Belief is different than questioning. Think about that. No one was ever condemned or sent to hell for asking that question, or doubting, is there a God? And yet the way we live, it's like it's the cardinal sin to ask the question. And so we want to take just a few moments here today, and my prayer is that you would engage in one of the Explore God groups. You can go online to their website, find a group, explore.com, and really dive into this question more. All right? We gave you some a message outline. It's in the middle of your worship folder. You can jot these down. Maybe you've been asked that question. Is there a God? And you're like, I'm not sure how to answer that. Like, I would say yes, but I'm not quite sure how to even have a conversation with that. Here's some great conversation pointers, and then we'll get to the story of Jesus that we heard earlier in our service. So if you're taking notes, you can write this down. One of the wonderful ways that we know that there is a God, or that there's evidence of God, is through creation. I mean, look around. Maybe you've experienced God in a non-church setting like I have. Maybe you're sitting there and you're listening to an orchestra play and the beauty of the music and it's sort of otherworldly, and you're sitting there and it's like, wow, there must be a God because no human being on their own can create something so beautiful. Or maybe you're a naturalist. You enjoy being out in nature, and you're going on hikes. It's like, wow, if God can create, if there is such complexity in creation, wow, there's got to be a God. And that's one way that you can begin understanding the evidence of the existence of God is through creation. David, King David, he writes this in Psalm 19. Let's read it together. "The heavens are telling the glory of God. They are a marvelous display of his craftsmanship." So the glory of God, the power and the presence of God, the heavens, the earth, the creation, everything around us, he says, is telling the story of God. Because they are a marvelous display. They are a reality of his craftsmanship. It's interesting where you find that word again later on in the New Testament, craftsmanship. It's in Ephesians. Paul's talking about how by grace we are saved through faith, not by our works, so that you can't boast and you can't boast and you can't boast and you can't boast. I can't boast. We're all saved by God's grace apart from ourselves. And then it goes on. Why? Because you are God's craftsmanship, created by him for the good works that he has prepared long in advance for you to do. And so, in other words, if we put this all together, you and me, we are God's craftsmanship for the purpose of his glory, his power, his presence. We are walking pieces of evidence of the reality of God's existence through creation. But it's not just through creation that we find the existence of God, but also through ethics or morality. All right, ethics or morality. Kids, we get this, right? As we grow older, this part of our reality, I believe it kind of gets hardened. All right, but kids, I mean, think about it. Students, if you're in here, preschool students, if you're listening to me, you get this little knot right about here, right? When you know you've been had. Or you kind of get this sweaty hand syndrome when you know you're kind of stuck with your parents and you know you've done something you really shouldn't have done, but there's no way you can go back and redo it. You know what I'm talking about, buddy? Yeah. We call that your conscience. Your conscience. This is what the Apostle Paul says about your conscience or morality, all right? People demonstrate that God's law is written on their hearts, for their own conscience and thoughts either accuse them or tell them that they are doing right. And it's true, if you think about it. How do you know? How did this conscience get there? How do you know innately something is right or wrong? Well, it's evidence that there is a God. There is something beyond yourself, someone beyond yourself who has created that, who has put that compass in you to know. But maybe you're not like into creation. You're not into like the conscience thing. You're like, okay. Maybe it's intelligence. Intelligence is another way that we have this evidence of God. All right, C.S. Lewis, he's a great author. He's a philosopher, much smarter than I am. This is what he writes. He says, humanity is not born with desires. Why? Let's read the yellow words together. Unless satisfaction for these desires exists. And this is how he unpacks it. A baby feels hunger, so there must be a such thing as food. A duck wants to swim, so there must be a such a thing as water. I feel sexual desire, so there must be such a thing as sex. If I find myself a desire which no experience in the world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is what? Let's read it together. I was made for something, for someone else. In a way, Jerry Maguire was right. Something else completes you. But it probably isn't your spouse or your kids. St. Augustine, he said that we all have this God-sized hole in our hearts, and we are not at rest, we are not satisfied, we are not whole until we find our rest or our completeness in God. Now, what C.S. Lewis and St. Augustine, what we would experience as human beings, all connects up. Because deep down, you and I, we know that there is something apart from God that we all search for. And until we find that satisfaction, whether it's a relational satisfaction or a monetary satisfaction or a purpose-driven satisfaction, until we find all that in the provision and the existence and the power and the presence of God, we will search and search and search. And we will fill our lives with all this other stuff. Indeed, we were made for something or someone else. And that in and of itself is proof or evidence that God exists. So we have creation, we have morality, we have intelligence. But here's the last one, all right? We're going to say this last word together. One, two, three.
Love.
It's kind of like we save the best for last. I should say God saves the best to last. Because if we look at the Gospel of John, you don't need to go there, but you can find it in John chapter 2. We have Jesus on the third day coming to a wedding in Cana. So this is the third day after he was baptized. So he's baptized. The next day he goes out and he calls his disciples together. He's going around. He's like, Matthew and James and John, you all follow me. And they all say, yes, I'll follow you. And they aren't the logical people. There were guys with doubts. There were guys with questions. There were folks who didn't make the mark in the Jewish system. In a way that they lived their lives. They were fishermen. And so most likely they would have had to go back to their family business. They were stuck. And they would have had all these questions. And now Jesus comes onto the scene. He just simply says, follow me. And they do. And on the next day, he calls more. He calls Philip and he says, follow me, Nathaniel, follow me. And he goes on and on and on. And somewhere along the line, between day 2 and day 3, he makes his way to Cana to this wedding with his family. And he's with his mom. Her name is Mary. All right, good. And so it's a family celebration. It's a little different than the weddings you and I, we might participate in. It's more than just the 45-minute ceremony and the 4-hour party and the $20,000 later bill. But this wedding would have expanded throughout pretty much an entire week. And it would be partying, it would be eating, it would be socializing, it would be drinking, like it would just be a party. If you think about it, and maybe you've never thought about this, a wedding in biblical terms, and even today if you think about it, is an expression or a picture of what heaven is like. Because there's the party, there's the bride and the groom that come together, and the two become one, just like believers in God become fully one when we go through those pearly gates, when he calls our name. We are one. We are at rest. We are at peace. We are complete. And so Jesus, he's at this wedding. And what happens? They run out of wine. That's a horrible, tragic experience, if you've ever had that happen to you. They didn't have Aldi, they didn't have Winking Owl, they didn't have Two-Buck Chuck to go out and get cases of, all right? And so, you know what Two-Buck Chuck is, right? I guess it's Three-Buck Chuck now. Just go to Trader Joe's, you'll know what I'm talking about. And so the wedding party, they're like, what's going on? We need more wine. And Mary, the mother of Jesus, who probably would have had an inkling that Jesus was a little different by this time. She goes up to Jesus like, Jesus, they have no wine. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Like, you know what to do. Jesus says, it's not time yet. It's not time for what? It's not time to make known the power and the presence of God. It's not time yet for people to know and to see another side of the evidence of God. It's not time to see the love of God displayed and shown in a different way. And so they leave the conversation, and you can imagine as Mary turns and she sees the servants, hey guys, it's Jesus. Just do whatever he says. All right? Just go with it. And so Jesus, you can imagine him standing in the room and he sees these jars that would have been kind of like our communion chalices. They were holy things. They were items that were set aside for a holy purpose. And so right away, Jesus is looking for something to use. And he takes the jars. It'd be like taking our chalice that we use for the Lord's Supper. It was already filled. And he says to the servants, go and take a cup, dip it in there, and take it to the master of ceremonies. Now, servants are just doing what Mary said, like, just go and do it. And somewhere along the way, the servants would have picked up, oh, this is Jesus. There's something going on here. We're not quite sure. And so they get to the master of ceremonies. Master of ceremonies takes a sip. And it's not Two-Buck Chuck. It's not Winking Owl. It's like the $190 Beaujolais sitting up on the top shelf that everybody's afraid to take down because you don't want to drop it. And this is what the master of ceremonies says, kind of in a confused sort of way. He says, everyone serves a good wine first. And when people have drunk freely, the poor wine. Why is that? Well, because good wine is meant to be drunk first, right? It's not rocket science. But, he says, you have kept the good wine, what? Until now. Was a miracle. And the miracle, it was a demonstration of the love of Jesus, the love of God, in the provision of something that was so much better than everything that had come before. We can look at creation, we can look at morality and ethics, we can look at intelligence, but Jesus, the love of God that we see in Jesus, in His provision, in His forgiveness, when He says it is finished on the cross, the provision of forgiveness, the provision of life as He raises from the dead, God has kept the best stuff until now. Yes, we can look at creation, we can look at our conscience, we can look at the logic that God has placed around us as evidence for who He is. But unless we look at the person and work of Jesus Christ and His power and His presence that He brings into the world, it's only then do we see the full evidence of the existence of God. You see, all these other things, they are good. But until now, until we see the power and the presence of Jesus in stories like this, in stories like Justin and Jessica and John on the back of your worship folder, until you and I, we experience the goodness and the power and the presence of Jesus in a very real and personal way, like when we come up to the Lord's Supper, when we get together in our groups and we bear our burdens, when we know people are praying with us and for us, it's only then do we experience the love of God beyond our wildest imaginations. And we, along with the master of ceremonies, say, wow, you have kept the best for now. And this is how it ends. This is the first sign that Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested. He made known His power in the presence of God. And this is what the disciples did. What did they do? And the disciples, they moved from asking the question and not knowing how to answer to, I have this trust now that now I've experienced, I've seen it. I have seen the power and the presence of God with my own eyes. And I now can answer that question, not just yes and I'm not sure, but yes, because Jesus is able to do miracles. He is able to show up. He's able for me to experience His love in a totally different way because Jesus is here. Here's how I want to close. Go ahead back into your groups. Share the response, your response with each other to this question. How would the world, and you can define that however you want, your family, your neighborhood, your own life, whatever. How would the world be different if you lived as if God was always with you? Go ahead and turn in your groups. If you found us online, you can jot down some notes in the discussion area or send us a direct message. We can know that God exists through creation. Maybe that's your way, and you just really relate in that way. Maybe it's through your conscience, and you're a black and white, right or wrong, blind in the sand sort of person, and that's how you know God exists. Maybe it's through your intellect and logic, and you just know logically. God exists, but I don't know about you, but for me, the greatest one is if I can feel and experience this love in ways I was not expecting. That's how I know that God exists. Let's stand and pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for your word and for manifesting, for making known your love to us. Whether that's through creation or our conscience or our intellect or just feeling and having the community that you have placed around us in their love and support. God, help us to know without a doubt that you exist. And not just be able to say yes, and I'm not sure, but yes. Because you have sent your son Jesus to make that known to me. Shape our hearts, shape our lives to live this reality out every day.